Now, let's take an extreme example of positivism and an extreme example of existentialism, and you'll see what I mean. In the 19th century, there were historians who were positivistic or historicistic and who said, all that you have to do in order to arrive at historical certainty is to get at the facts. Simply set out the facts and there is no discussion. Well, some very interesting things happen. One historical positivist would study a particular historical problem. And he would set forth the facts and draw the obvious conclusion. Then, another positivist would investigate the same event or events, set out the facts, and draw his conclusion. And the conclusions would sometimes be mutually incompatible. Most of these historical positivists were Germans. And indeed, the Germans have had a funny way of operating positivistically in many areas of investigation. There's a story told about Hegel, and I was talking about him Monday night as well, that a student at one point in one of Hegel's lectures on the philosophy of history raised his hand and said, but Professor Hegel, the facts do not agree with you. And the master is said to have replied, then the facts be hanged, and went on with his presentation. This is apocryphal and certainly not fair to Hegel, and the same story is told about Kant, so there's obviously something the matter here. But this showed a mindset. Those of you who mess about a bit in theology will regard a story like this as Geschichtsschrift, historical in that sense. The tendency has been to consider one's own interpretation as so clearly related to the facts that there is no sense in even bringing up counter-arguments. If I have spoken, then that's the way the facts are. This immediately suggests a difficulty with this approach. The approach does not recognize the extent to which bias can enter into an examination of the facts. The humorous thing is that one historical positivist would absolutely castigate another when they came to mutually incompatible conclusions. Because on the basis of the positivist viewpoint, if another person disagreed with him, the other person either had to be stupid or perverse. If it's simply a matter of examining the facts, and the facts speak, and lo and behold, you come to a single clear conclusion, then if somebody else examines the facts and comes to another conclusion, obviously the other person is either stupid, he hasn't done his work right, or perverse. Now, of course, logically, the individual himself could be stupid or perverse, but one or the other, or both, would have to be in this kind of difficulty. What the positivist did not recognize was the extent to which extraneous factors influence one's interpretation of the facts. Later on in this period, we will have a chance to see exactly the extent to which this comes about. And one of the mimeographs that you've received, and which we'll be looking at in a couple of minutes, points this out quite clearly by example. Now let's take an extreme case over here, the existentialist. The existentialist says, reality exists insofar as it touches my personal existence. My personal existence is the determinative element in the way things are. If you were here on Monday night, you recall that I talked about how Kierkegaard criticized Hegel. Kierkegaard said, why Hegel is thinks that he can set forth the essence of the universe. Nobody can set forth the essence of the universe. You've got to begin with your own personal experience. Your personal experience is the limit of what is known. Well, when the existentialist turns to historical study, naturally, his attitude is that interpretation is everything. It depends upon the personal interpretation of the historian, what the results are. Now you say, but what about the events? Ah, says the existentialist, what events really? The events come to you only through the eyes of interpreters. If there weren't any people to copy down the information, you would not even know that the events had occurred. And since these people all take down the material selectively, you're getting from the very beginning somebody's interpretation. In other words, you never can get back to events themselves. You never get farther back than interpreters of events. Thus, everything is interpretation. So on the one hand, you have people saying everything is the fact, everything consists of events, and on the other hand, people saying everything consists of interpretation. But we've already seen some difficulties with this view over here. What about the view over here? It's often useful to take an existentialist down to a very busy corner at the height of the rush hour. And take him down to B Street, and First in San Diego, when the traffic is zooming along at 5 o'clock or so. And you say to him, now, my friend, those trucks and cars that are out there, do they have factual and objective existence wholly apart from your personal experience? Existentialist. Well, if they do, that isn't the important thing. The important thing, after all, is my experience of the whole business. If pushed, the existentialist would move toward a position called solipsism. Now, solipsism is that view, philosophically, which says nothing exists unless I personally experience it. Nothing actually exists. The world doesn't exist unless I experience it. Most existentialists don't go that far, but existentialism moves in that direction. It moves, in other words, in the direction of complete and utter subjectivity. After the existentialist has said this, you push him into the traffic. He crawls up on the opposite curb, his clothing is shredded, he is gray and shaking, and you say to him, now, do you conceive that the traffic has objective existence? And he tends, under those conditions, to admit the objectivity of the event of the traffic, wholly apart from the question of his own personal experience. That is to say, on the next occasion, when he stands there on the curb, he will tend to view the situation more seriously as to the objectivity of the traffic before he leaps out. Yes. But that's why I added what I just did, that on the next occasion, he looks much more carefully ahead of time. You see, if it really were the case that the traffic were not objectively there, see, until he got out into the street and met the vehicle head on, then there would be no point in looking, right? There'd be no point in looking while he was on the curb. The point of all of this is that the existentialist or the solipsist, we're not using them synonymously, but the existentialist or the solipsist is bound to admit, under conditions such as this, that there are events that stand apart from his personal experience by the very weight of the material in question.
Isn't this personal experience going to be a rocket? that is personal experience for anyone watching, you have to get run over. He would have to stand there and experience it, you know what I'm saying?
Yes, but that tends to bring him to the point of holding that, if he examines what's involved, that the stuff out there has reality regardless of his personal experience because of the universality of this kind of experience. Take a case of a historical problem. This might be easier to see. If the positivists were right, everybody would come to precisely the same conclusion historically, right? If the existentialists were right, then there would be as many different histories written as there are individuals, because the existentialist is very strong on the uniqueness of the individual existential experience. He does not want to have generalization made on the basis of this. Generalization, in fact, moves in the direction of universal statements, and that's what he doesn't like. However, isn't it remarkable that even though there are considerable differences among historians, the degree of uniformity and unanimity among them. That is, it's extremely difficult to pick up a history book which says that Abraham Lincoln died by slipping in the bathtub. No matter who writes the book, whether he is a Marxist or a member of the John Birch Society, the conclusion seems to be arrived at that something happened to Lincoln in the Ford Theater and Booth was responsible. See? There appear to be data which stand over against all the interpreters and which are not dependent on the subjective stance of particular interpreters. Now, suppose the person pursues this and says, what about the point I raised originally? Those original data did come from people looking at things. Sure. But people of diverse viewpoints and people who were not crazy or perverse describe historical events in the same terms, you see? Which also pushes us back to events that stand over against the interpreter. It appears that there is a residual stuff in history which cannot be altered no matter how the interpreter wants to alter it. Now, what are we arriving at here? What we're arriving at is a conclusion, and we've seen it coming, that history, in the second sense, does not consist only of facts, nor does it consist only of interpretation. In some sense, both are involved. And the question is, what is the exact relationship between them? Is it a continuum? Now, a continuum is a thing like a thermometer. A thermometer is a continuum, or a barometer. Any point on this has a degree of heat and a degree of cold. You can't say at one point on the thermometer, this point is hot, or that point is cold. It's a matter of degree, eh? And it runs from hot to cold. You've all taken part in one of those high school science experiments where there is a bowl of lukewarm water, and one person puts his hand in the refrigerator, and the other person has his hand boiled over a low flame, and then the two people plunge their hands into the same lukewarm water. And the question is, what is the temperature of the water? Is it hot or is it cold? And of course, it depends upon your experience just prior to that. It can be regarded either way. In other words, there's a degree of hotness and a degree of coldness connected with both of these. Now, is that the case when we talk about the relationship between facts and interpretation? That is, does history consist of so much fact and so much interpretation? Well, at first you might say yes, but obviously, if you examine this more closely, that doesn't solve the issue. Is it 63% fact and 37% interpretation. How about 40 and 60? You can see that any point along this continuum would be chosen arbitrarily and would solve nothing. The fact is that this kind of a concept is off base in itself. That is, this kind of model, use the scientific expression, this kind of model is off base. And yet, a great deal of historical work has been based upon some kind of a model like this. The philosopher of history has said, we have a blending of fact and interpretation, and it's more this than it is that. And the other fellow comes along and says, oh no, it's more that than it is this. But this gets nowhere because you can't establish any division points. Let me suggest a different kind of model. I'm going to give you three models, actually, of different kinds so that you can choose the one you prefer. But all of these make the same point. Think of historical work as consisting of facts and interpretation related as two levels of a pyramid. Now, fundamental to the historical enterprise are the facts. Why? Well, if the facts are not fundamental, then how do you distinguish the writing of novels from the writing of history? Let's take some great historical novel, like any one of Sir Walter Scott's novels. Now, these are great stuff. There you get the knighthood in flower. The knights trot across the field after the equivalent of dragons, the fair damsels are rescued, etc., etc. Now, this is great writing. If there are no facts that stand objectively as the fundament of history by which you can judge that kind of thing, why isn't Sir Walter Scott's operation as good as that of any professional medieval historian? Why isn't Sir Walter Scott as good as Carl Stevenson in dealing with the Middle Ages? Well, the point is that Carl Stevenson endeavors to stay close to the facts, whereas the novelist creates the facts in the course of the narrative. The difference between a novelist and a historian lies at this point. The historian is trying to set forth what in fact happened. Now, what about interpretation? Interpretation endeavors to understand the facts. It's an attempt to put the facts together in such a way that they are understandable and so that the result is faithful to the events. Interpretation, in other words, rests on facts, and the value of interpretation depends upon the facts. Put it this way, an interpretation is a good one insofar as it relates to the facts. Let me show you two examples of interpretations that don't have the right relationship to facts. Let's take this. Now here we have a grandiose interpretation which is related to a limited number of facts. Now this diagram represents a lot of work in philosophy of history. There is a fabulous view, panoramic view, with one trouble. The facts that are used to support this are so minuscule that the whole thing is top-heavy. Then we have this kind of situation. This is the typical doctoral dissertation in history. You see? Where the facts you have got up to here, but the writer, for fear that he will be bombed by his committee, presents as narrow and small an area of interpretation possible, because on the level of interpretation he extends himself in such a way that it would be possible for his committee to grab it. As a matter of fact, you could plot a historian's career often as starting here and ending here. Eventually, a historian may reach that enviable position where he simply can set forth interpretations without any documentation. This is known as the Delphic Oracle stage. Now let me give you another model. This is a model presented by the theologian Ian Ramsey in another connection. Says Ramsey, the relationship, and he gets this from the philosopher Wittgenstein, whom I mentioned on Monday class. Says Ramsey, interpretation is to fact as a shoe is to a foot. Interpretation is to fact as a shoe is to a foot. Now, think of your foot and think of a shoe. The best shoe is the one that precisely fits your foot. The best interpretation is the one that precisely fits the fact. Two mistakes can be made, and I've diagrammed them in a different way just a second ago. You can have an interpretation which is like a great big shoe. Now, in that situation, that shoe is so big that it not only will fit your foot, it'll fit the feet of any 10 people that you happen to meet. Now, such a shoe is not a very good one. An interpretation which is so broad that it will fit 10 different sets of facts that are unrelated and perhaps contradictory is in very bad shape. Then you can have a shoe that pinches the foot. An interpretation that crunches the facts is likewise a very bad interpretation. This is the Procrustean bed type of interpretation. Some of you remember the bed of Procrustes. This was a fellow in Greek mythology who just loved to have guests at his home. He had a bed of only one size. And when the guest arrived, Procrustes took the guest, and if the guest was too short, he stretched him until he fit the bed. And if he were too long, he chopped him off at either end until he fit the bed. Now, in historical activity, there are some people who take the interpretation and force the fact to fit it. They grab the interpretation, they grab the fact, and they plunk it down into the Procrustean bed of their own interpretation and whack, whack, off on either end if it doesn't fit, or until it does fit. The proper interpretation is the one that fits the fact. How do we go about determining what interpretation is good or better of a historical event? Well, we take the various interpretations and we compare them with the facts that they endeavor to interpret. In other words, the facts are the judge and the interpretations are brought before the bar of that judgment. The facts determine what interpretation is to be accepted. Now let me give you the third, or maybe fourth, consider the judge as a third model. Let me give you a fourth model. This is a biological model, and I give this because this particular pyramidal diagram seems terribly static, of course, Procrustean beds are very, very static and all. And you know, we are now living in a day where in theology you must be dynamic. If you've done any work at all in this area, you know that theologians are constantly saying we don't want to be static, we want to be dynamic. So I give you a dynamic illustration, and it goes as follows. The interpretation is like, let's begin with the fact. The fact is like a mama kangaroo, and the interpretation is like the baby kangaroo. Now, you know that mama kangaroo has a pouch and keeps the baby in the pouch normally. All right? If you want to see a baby kangaroo, you must not go up to the mama kangaroo with a club and batter over the head with it. This makes the mama kangaroo very irritable, and she will put her paws over her tummy and will not show you the baby kangaroo. On the other hand, if you look deeply into her big brown eyes and you show her that you want to put yourself at her disposal, that you appreciate her, then with a big grin on her face, she will reach into her pouch and show you the baby. Now, the facts of history are like the mama kangaroo. If a person goes to those facts with set interpretations, biases, and whack over the head of history, history will do this, and you will never get the right interpretation. Or if you do, it'll be by sheer chance. If you are nice to the facts, if you put yourself at their disposal, then they will reveal the interpretation themselves. In other words, the people who get to know what history means are those who are willing to put themselves at history's disposal. Yes, sir?
That's different from the positive history.
Yes, you're right with me, because that was precisely what I was going to. This differs from the positivistic extreme, which I guess we all... No, here it is. This differs from the positivistic extreme in that it recognizes the influence of bias in arriving at poor interpretations. You see, the positivist insisted that there was only one solution possible, and that if that solution was not arrived at, either ignorance or perversity was involved. Something else can be involved, which is neither ignorance nor perversity. It is simply the influence of biases or commitments on one as one deals with the facts. Now, we agree with the positivists that the ideal is to reduce such biases or commitments to a minimum, or at least to recognize these, so that they don't act as an unconscious influence on interpretation. But we differ from the positivist in saying that, as a matter of fact, the presence of such biases is a common phenomenon and is not to be regarded as perverse at all. What we're saying is that the positivist is right in his ideal. He is wrong in his understanding of why people fail in this ideal. The existentialist is wrong in his conception of the nature of the ideal. Thus, if it were a question of choosing between positivism and existentialism in historical interpretation, we'd have to choose over here. We would have to. Why? Because if you give up the facts, you haven't got any history to deal with. We already pointed out that this is fundamental to what follows. If we gave up the facts, we would be unable to distinguish from that point on novels from history, stories from journalism. Now, the problem at this point is to determine the degree to which one's commitments have an influence over one's historical operation. And that takes us directly to one of the mimeographs that you have in your hands. And this is the primary source illustration. The primary source illustration. This is a short mimeograph of two leaves, four pages. Now for next time, will you please make sure that you have read, are there any people who don't have this, by the way? Anybody have this? Ah, okay, maybe someone would take a few of these up the line. We have plenty of them. For next time, would you please make sure that you have read the first two chapters of The Shape of the Past? The first two chapters of The Shape of the Past. The first chapter connects with this mimeograph. And for those of you who came in after the distribution of books and materials, please make sure that you come down here at the end of the period, which will be in about 2 or 3 minutes, and make sure that you pick up the materials so you'll be all set. In The Shape of the Past, I point out that there are three major areas of commitment that people bring to their study of history and that color the way in which they operate with the facts. Now, no positivist would get into this sort of thing. So that's a further aspect in answering your question. These three aspects of these three ways in which people's commitments influence their historical study are human nature. That's the first category on the mimeograph sheet. Then significance, and the third, the past, or the nature of time. That is, each person who goes into a study of the past already has a conception of human nature. He has an idea as to what is significant. And he has a conception as to his relationship to the past. And the views that a person holds in these areas have a direct influence on the results of his historical investigation. Now, we'll look at the first of these illustrations, just to show you where we're going, and then you'll be able to proceed on this in preparation for next week. On the first page here is ostensibly a straight description of American Indians and other Aborigines. Among the North American Indians, we see how an originally homogeneous tribe gradually spreads over a huge continent. And a wonderful constitution it is, this Gentile constitution. The next should be in square brackets, that's an insertion. That is, the socio-political organization of Indian tribes, in all its childlike simplicity. No soldiers, no gendarmes or police, no nobles, kings, regents, prefects, or judges, no prisons, no lawsuits, and everything takes its orderly course. All quarrels and disputes are settled by the whole of the community affected, by the gens or the tribe, or by the gentes among themselves. Only as an extreme and exceptional measure is blood revenge threatened, and our capital punishment is nothing but blood revenge in a civilized form, with all of the advantages and drawbacks of civilization. Although there were many more matters to be settled in common than today, the household is maintained by a number of families in common and is communistic. The land belongs to the tribe, only the small gardens are allotted provisionally to the households, yet there is no need for even a trace of our complicated administrative apparatus with all its ramifications, and so on. Then the writer gets to the subject of the Zulu and the Nubians, and they turn out to be stronger, more powerful than the Europeans who fought against them. Armed with only lances and spears, without firearms, under a hail of bullets from the breech loaders of the English infantry, they advanced right up to the bayonets and more than once through the lines into disorder. A Kaffir travels farther and faster in 24 hours than a horse. His smallest muscle stands out hard and firm like whipcord. That is what men in society were before the division into classes. Now, as you read this narrative, you get the funny feeling that something is going on here other than a straight description of Indians. Even if you have not spent your evenings watching the late night westerns on TV, you get the suspicion that somehow this is not a full picture of Indian life, nor a full picture of the lives of Zulu or Nubians. Something funny is going on. And there are a few revealing expressions in the narrative that give you an idea as to what is going on. For example, concerning the Indians, although there were many more matters to be settled in common than today, the household is maintained by a number of families in common and is communistic. And then, way down at the bottom, that is what men in society were before the division into classes. As it turns out, this description of Indians comes from The Origin of the Family, Private Property in the State, a writing of Friedrich Engels. Now, Engels was to Karl Marx what Huntley is to Brinkley. Friedrich Engels was the sidekick of Karl Marx. Engels and Marx together wrote the Communist Manifesto. What we have here is a description of the Indians, a la the Marxist view of human nature. Engels began his study of these Indians with the conviction that human beings are basically good unless they are corrupted by a class structure in society. Now, if you start out with that assumption and you come across people in history who do not have a class structure, why, by George, it follows like the night, the day, that they must have had an idealistic life. Now, we are not denying that the Indians did not have any gendarmes. We are not denying that allotted their small gardens provisionally to the households, etc., etc. I'm sure that there must have been Indians who did this. But the point is that there are lots of facts about the Indians not included here. For example, their delightful activities in spread-eagling each other, so on. The kind of activities that you have encountered on late-night television, which do, believe it or not, have some relation to what went on among the Indians. The fact is that the Indians, like people after the division into classes, had some nice habits and some nasty habits. But Engels chooses to give us only the nice things about the Indians, as he does about the Zulu and the Nubians. Probably a Kaffir did travel farther and faster in 24 hours than a horse, but that isn't the full picture. You see, the commitment as to human nature had a tremendous bearing on the kind of historical narrative that is here set forth. We're not saying that this is ignorance or perversity on the part of Engels. We are saying simply that his view of human nature, which he took to the study of the Indians, colored the results. And whether this interpretation is correct or not depends upon whether this interpretation does properly fit the facts concerning the Indians, the Nubians, and the Zulu. And we need all the facts, not just some of them. If we take this view of the Indians as compared with other views of the Indians, where does it stand? We could range the various interpretations. We could criticize them by comparing them with the facts, and some would come out with a high score, and some would come out with a low score. I have a feeling that this would come out with a very low score. Even if I were an Indian agent, even if I were working for the Department of Indian Affairs, I would feel that it deserved a low score. Now, when you read the first chapter of The Shape of the Past, you'll get into the subject of sovereign decisions or interpretations that are influenced by prior commitments. And we're going to continue with this next time, and we will be going on with some of the other examples here, but very briefly. Then we will move on from there to a discussion of the nature of time, because that relates to the third of these commitments, our relationship to the past. And there we will get into the question of time travel and what that involves, or would involve. And you will quickly see the direct theological application of this sort of thing. You'll quickly see that the relationship between fact and interpretation has a tremendous bearing on how you treat religious events and how you build a total philosophy of history. As in the case of the Monday class, there will not be time for discussion tonight because of the preliminaries. But in the future, we will arrange this so that there is approximately one-third of the time available for discussion right here in the class period. So if you feel terribly repressed and frustrated, don't feel that way. Come to Dr. Young's on Tuesday night and wait until the next class period for an opportunity to ask questions directly in this session. Thank you very much.